This is a recording of the public hearing on coordinated communications held by the Federal Election Commission on March 2nd and 3rd, 2010. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
The special session of the Federal Election Commission will come to order. I'd like to welcome everyone to the Commission's hearing on proposed rules regarding coordinated communications. This hearing will take place over the course of 2 days, starting today and concluding tomorrow. On both days, we will discuss the notice of proposed rulemaking on coordinated communications, which was published in the Federal Register on October 21, 2009, and the supplemental notice of proposed rulemaking on coordinated communications, which was published in the Federal Register on February 10, 2010. The NPRM explained and sought comment on proposed rules in response to the decision of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit in Shays versus the FEC, more commonly known as Shays 3. The supplemental NPRM elicited additional comments on those proposed rules in light of the Supreme Court's decision in the Citizens United versus FEC case. I'd like to thank all the people who took the time and effort to comment on the proposed rules, and in particular those who will appear today and tomorrow as witnesses to give us the benefit of their practical experience and expertise on the issues raised by the proposed rules. Let me describe briefly the format that we'll be following today and tomorrow. We will have a total of 11 witnesses who have been divided into three panels. We will hear from two panels today and one panel tomorrow. Each panel will last for 1.5 hours, and we'll have the first panel this morning followed by a lunch break, and then the second panel this afternoon. Each witness will have 5 minutes to make an opening statement. We have a light system set up at the table to help you keep track of time. The green light will start to flash with 1 minute left. The yellow light will go on when you have 30 seconds left, and when the red light pops up, that means that it's time to wrap up the remarks. Then the balance of time will be reserved for questioning by the commissioners. For each panel, we will have at least one round of questions from the commissioners, the general counsel, and the staff director, and if time permits, we'll have subsequent rounds of questions as well. I look forward to the discussion over the next couple of days between my colleagues up here on the commission and those who will be testifying regarding the rules that apply to coordination, which is an issue that whose importance has only been elevated by the recent Citizens United decision. I understand some of my colleagues would like to make some opening remarks as well. The Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, I'd like to thank you and your staff and the General Counsel staff and the other staff of the agency for putting together this hearing. We have a number of witnesses over the next day and a half, and I'd like to thank all of them as well for being willing to be here and share their views with us, and for all of those who provided written comments as well. It's extremely helpful to us as we attempt to, once again, craft an appropriate regulation under the statute. The specific elements that could go into crafting a meaningful rule to govern coordinated communications provide ample fodder for discussion, disagreement, and thoughtful argument. But as we all know, we're not writing on a blank slate. As some commenters have duly noted, it's an unenviable task before us, and I assure you we appreciate your sympathy. Our task is, of course, to respond to the Shays 3 Court's view that the express advocacy outside the window is an enormous loophole, in its words. The court concluded that the express advocacy standard not only frustrates Congress's goal of prohibiting soft money from being used in connection with federal elections, but provides a clear roadmap for doing so. So we are here today to try to understand how to structure a regulation to address the court's view that the prior rule did not rationally separate election-related advocacy from other speech. We must also address the court's concern about our time window for common vendors and former employees in the conduct prong. And we've received some very helpful comments, and I'd like to discuss some of those in more depth today and tomorrow. Because while we might be able to agree that information does lose value over time, defining at precisely what point in time that occurs in a manner that will satisfy the court will require, I think, further detail. So I look forward to those conversations with commenters. The task before us is not an easy one, but it is our duty to respond to the court's decision by expanding the content standard applicable outside the window and more fully explaining the appropriate time window for the conduct standard. We appreciate your written comments and your time, and I thank the chairman.
Thank you. Any further statements? Commissioner Hunter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you to all our witnesses. We look forward to your comments and really appreciate your written comments. They definitely helped me clarify which issues are before us and which ones we can flesh out today. Along those lines, I just wanted to say, as the Vice Chair said, the Shays 3 Court directed us to develop a rule that rationally separates election-related advocacy from other activity. And I think, you know, we have to look at the two sides of crafting that rule. On one hand, we'd like to find a bright-line rule that considers the concerns about the chilling effect of imprecise rules. But on the other hand, I think we all want to avoid a two-part, 11-factor balancing test that the Supreme Court so clearly disfavored. In response to reading the comments, I think perhaps, and I want to clarify it as much as I can to say perhaps, the WRTL standard in the view of most commenters might be an appropriate place to land. And one of the things in particular that I'm looking forward to hearing about today is, do commenters believe that the WRTL standard as proposed, which is essentially just the Supreme Court's test, is clear enough on its face, or would it benefit by additional information in order for people to determine whether or not the speech is election-related or not? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hunter. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was appointed to this commission exactly one day after the adoption of the coordination regulations that first issued after BCRA at the end of 2002. And it was not an accident that they waited until after that vote that the president waited to appoint me to the commission. At the time, I was a little bit frustrated because I thought, darn, I've been sitting out here waiting for months and you know, they've been doing all these interesting rulemakings and I just didn't have a chance to participate in that. And I just want to say that I am no longer frustrated.
Thank you, Commissioner Weintraub. Commissioner McGann.
That's a tough act to follow, but I'll try. I want to thank the chairman first for doing something that this group of commissioners hasn't done, which is give opening statements and allowing that in this hearing. I think opening statements are important because in some rulemakings because it's tough for commenters to sometimes know where various commissioners are until it's too late, and we sometimes question in the abstract. And I think given the history of this particular rule that has gone on for years and years and years, it makes sense to try to define some issues and share with the public where some of us are, and particularly where I am, going into this having read the comments. Obviously, we're here to talk about Shays 3, and in particular the coordination content standard. There, the D.C. Circuit said a rule that had magic words as the content test for the year-round standard was not enough. Various options have been presented. One's promote, attack, support, oppose, which is another portion of the statute that some may suggest we export from its context in McCain-Feingold into the coordination regime. Most comments have said that's not a good idea. Question I will have for commenters, though, is, for those who do support it, they tend to say it's a clean standard and it's been upheld by the Supreme Court. Is that really true in the context of a coordination rulemaking? Certainly it was upheld on its face in its use in the statute for spending by party committees, but can we really take a standard that is designed for, as one commenter suggested, sophisticated political actors and apply it to others? The standard most comments seem to have coalesced around for a variety of reasons is the Wisconsin Right to Life standard, as Commissioner Hunter suggested. The problem with this, obviously, is the Citizens United case undid, presumably, much of it, but maybe it is still a standard as viable in coordination. The question I have, though, is can we export it from its roots and then have it be a free-floating test without all the other attachments, meaning it was a test designed to construe a statute that had objective criteria like referencing a federal candidate within a certain time period. And if we do use this test, do we have to be careful that we also take with it the various limiting factors that Chief Justice Roberts articulated in his opinion? Because my fear is if we do not do something like that, and I'd be curious to hear from the commenters if they agree or disagree with this, do we end up going down the road that the commission had gone down with with the much maligned Section 100.22B, which was a reg purporting to define express advocacy, probably well-intentioned, but if one reads the Fergatch decision upon which it was upon which it finds its genesis, it's how the commission has interpreted subsection B over the years is a far cry from the facts of Fergatch, and I don't think we should have a standard that then is allowed to just exponentially grow over the years. And the question is, do we concern ourselves with that here or not? Because ultimately, we're defining a term which is expenditure, and that comes with it a lot of baggage and a lot of water under the bridge, not only with Shays 3. Some argue that although the Supreme Court's defined expenditure one way, in Buckley, that's only limited into independent speech. That doesn't apply once the speech is coordinated. It should be a different standard. And the Shays 3 court does give some cover to that argument, but that does not mean, I think, that it's an anything goes, know it when you see it standard, because ultimately we are still defining a term, and I think all the various vagueness concerns that the courts have articulated over the years still apply. I'd be curious to hear from the commenters if they agree or disagree with that. In particular, what the commission has struggled with is really specifics. We'll probably hear from commenters that if the rule goes too far, it'll chill the ability to speak. I think instinctively we all know that's true on some level, but I'd be curious to hear from commenters specifically why it would chill, why a rule that goes too far would cause people to hedge and trim. I'm thinking of perhaps some past MERS the commission had engaged in. I think some of the commenters were counsel of record in some larger investigations on coordination. Maybe that would be helpful to discuss. Other commenters have claimed that when expenditures are coordinated with a candidate or party, they're legally indistinguishable from expenditures made by a candidate or party. I'd like to hear from the commenters whether or not they think that's true. I can see on one level how they're making the argument, but on the other hand, particularly from a state or local party perspective, not all spending by state or local parties are expenditures. Merely because it comes from a party. It may be a disbursement, it may be an issue ad, it may be a state campaign expenditure, but it seems to me that that sort of argument goes too far, as perhaps the express advocacy test doesn't apply to the definition of expenditure when spending is done by a candidate or party. Same commenter makes that argument. That would then mean all spending by parties are expenditures. And we know that's not true. Otherwise, Congress would not have had to introduce the promote, attack, support, or oppose test with respect to federal election activity. Ultimately, though, all this turns on our old friend, the distinction between contribution and expenditure. Some comments seem to spill much ink on court citation. Some of it is persuasive. Some of it seems to merely label things on the contribution side. I'd like to know, are we really regulating expenditures here? And if so, can we survive strict scrutiny? Because although today we're concerned about surviving a potential Shays 4, of course it won't be called Shays 4. Probably we'd have to find another plaintiff. But what about an attack on the other side that says it goes too far? And then the remaining issues, I'd like to hear from about the common vendor, former employee. It seems to me that it's a good rule to have a bright line. Unfortunately, the commission, according to the Shays 3 court, didn't really support it. One could see a person right out of college taking their first job in politics and then realizing a month later when they have a better offer, they can't take the job because, well, the Federal Election Commission might say that could cause a coordination investigation. So I think there, if commenters are in favor of the rule, they ought to provide specific examples, not just a general thing about, oh, it's nice to have people be able to move around jobs. I think we need specifics. With that, Mr. Chairman, I yield back. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner McGann.
Commissioner, other than to thank everyone for coming in, I'm going to pass on comments at this time. And also thank you for those of you from the Hill that are here. It's nice to see that you're willing to take some time and listen to some of the presentations that are going to be made today.
All right. Thank you, Commissioner Walther. We'll begin with our first panel then. Our first panel this morning consists of Jan Barron on behalf of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Craig Holman on behalf of Public Citizen, and William McGinley of Patton Boggs. I don't know if you'll take your places at the Mr. Barron, you're on the far left, McGinley on the
far right.
Yeah, that's right. All right. As I mentioned earlier, each of you will have 5 minutes to make an opening statement. And why don't we start with Mr. Barron and then move our way across the table. So whenever you're ready, feel free to proceed.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good morning, commissioners and staff. Appreciate this opportunity to appear at this rulemaking hearing. I am representing the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. The Chamber was a party in the McConnell litigation. It also has been very active as an amicus in many of the Supreme Court cases that we may be discussing this morning, including Wisconsin Right to Life case and, of course, the Citizens United case. And in this Citizens United case, our brief was cited multiple times in both the majority opinion and the dissent. This constitutes my third appearance at a hearing on this subject matter, starting in 2002 before Commissioner Weintraub was here, and then again in 2006 and now today. So some of what we will discuss will surely be deja vu all over again. I would like to just emphasize that consistently through these hearings and in our comments on behalf of the Chamber, we emphasize two particular aspects of this rulemaking. One was we urge the Commission, as it has attempted to do, to be sensitive to the First Amendment rights that are at issue in all of these regulations, the rights of freedom of speech, freedom of association, and particularly important to the Chamber is the right to petition government for redress of grievances. And as I'm sure many of you know, the Chamber of Commerce is one of the most active and largest lobbying organizations here in Washington, D.C., and they're exercising that important First Amendment right. The second element that the Chamber has emphasized in all these rulemakings is a plea for clarity. We know that we join many others who are urging the Commission to establish bright-line tests. This is very important, not only for those of us who have to comply with your regulations, but it's obviously very important to the Commission. You have limited resources. You'd like to have clear regulations so that people know what the rules are, that they will follow them, and then it'll make your enforcement life a lot easier if the rules are clear. For that reason, in our comments, we have urged rejection of the so-called PASO test in this rulemaking, and we have urged the Commission to consider adopting the Wisconsin Right to Life test in this regulation. Since the Shays 3 court has concluded that express advocacy is too limited, the Commission's burden is to come up with some additional content standard, and we believe that although it is not perfect, the Wisconsin Right to Life standard is something that people are familiar with. It's already in your regulations. And in fact, the regulated community has had experience under that standard in the 2008 election. And I note also that both corporate and union and other types of organizations seem to have effectively used that standard just 2 days before the Citizens United opinion in a special election in Massachusetts. I believe that the forms that have been filed with the commission by many organizations who engaged in electioneering communications that were protected by the Wisconsin Right to Life standard exceeded several millions of dollars. So there is evidence here that people are familiar with that standard. We did not specifically comment on the common vendor issue, but I would like to urge the Commission to consider two things. One is please retain the firewall element of the of that particular standard. It's something people are familiar with, can be executed, and seems to work. And in terms of a time limit, which I know that you have to struggle with, I would suggest that maybe you ought to look at your longstanding polling regulations for allocation of expenditures on polling. These are regulations that have been in existence since, I think, 1977. It essentially concludes that polls lose all of their value after 180 days. They become worthless. Somebody can actually give a poll that's that old to a campaign, and it doesn't have any value under this regulation. Perhaps that has some relevance to whether or not the knowledge of a former employee or former vendor may be equally antiquated and valueless, because that is what the common vendor former employee regulation is seeking to prevent. You know, insider information that is taken from a campaign and given to an independent spender. Finally, I would like to conclude by noting that there have been some suggestions that perhaps the coordination rules for some speakers ought to be different than for other speakers. I don't see what the constitutional legal basis would be for that. I would just say that whatever is not coordination for one speaker should not be coordination for all speakers, and that the coordination rules ought to be applied even-handedly to all independent speakers. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Barron. Mr. Holman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commission, for letting me testify, especially since I asked so late in the process. To start off, I want to highlight the fact that the type of campaign financing communications we're talking about in coordinated communications should be viewed and must be viewed as similar to candidate activity and not third-party group independent expenditure activity. We are talking about activity that is coordinated with candidates and with parties, and as courts from Buckley there on in, including Citizens United, has recognized that coordinated activity must be treated differently than independent expenditure activity and abide by a different standard. Citizens United has dramatically increase the importance of a careful and effective coordination communication regulations developed by the FEC. The case itself only addressed independent expenditure activity, but in unleashing a vast new pool of finances in campaigns, Citizens United has fundamentally changed the dynamics of the financing of campaign practices, of which we're not even sure how yet. We're going to see it unfold before us. It's sort of like a new Wild West that this country has never seen before. We'll see how it plays out. But from some past activity, we can understand that there is a heightened danger of potential corruption. Corporations have not been shy to give hundreds of millions of dollars in soft money campaign contributions or in issue advocacy expenditures, and often and through PAC contributions. And it almost always goes to help benefit incumbents as opposed to challengers. That is, you know, different corporations will make different political expenditures for different reasons. But clearly, one of the overriding basis of corporate involvement in candidate elections is to try to endear themselves to lawmakers. This is a very, very high potential for excessive undue influence peddling. And as we saw also in the McConnell litigation, there is the reverse possibility of corruption that's often overlooked in these discussions, and that is lawmakers actually shaking down corporations for finances, for financial support for the campaigns. Essentially, a potential to return to the old system of party bosses. These two potentially corrupting factors that have been highlighted, have been maximized by the Citizens United decision, really accentuate the importance of coming up with a very careful, coordinated communications regulation. The number one change that can be done, the single most important thing that the Federal Election Commission can do is come up with a more capturing content criteria for those types of coordinated communications that are outside the pre-election window. And that it would be the PESO standard. As I'm one of the principal authors of the Buying Time Studies, as well as the Shea Court has recognized, the Express Advocacy Standard is functionally meaningless. Almost no one says vote for or vote against. You know, when it comes to third-party groups, according to my study in 2000, only about 2% of those ads ever said vote for or elect or don't elect somebody. Even candidates don't use that expression. It's just considered tacky when it comes to campaigning for oneself. They just don't say vote for me. So it really is not a practice that is done in campaign activity. The Wisconsin Right to Life Standard, the functional equivalent of express advocacy, suffers from much of the same problem because it is so narrow and focuses on that type of express advocacy. But much, much more importantly, the Wisconsin Right to Life Standard focused on independent expenditures, not coordinated expenditures. We need to recognize that when we're talking about coordinated communications, we're talking about the types of ads that really are designed, promoted, suggested by the candidates, and they should be treated by a similar standard that we treat the ads of candidates, and that is the PESO standard. I just want to conclude, I have much more to say, but I'm sure we'll get into some of this later. I just want to conclude that the PESO standard is a content criteria that does not stand alone when we talk about a coordinated communications regulation. It is complemented, supplemented by the conduct criteria. So when you combine both the content criteria and the conduct standards, that's where you can provide a reasonable, yet effective, and yet safe coordinated communications regulation.
Thank you, Mr. Holman. Mr. McGinley.
Mr. Chairman, commissioners, thank you for the opportunity to be with you today. Initially, I'd like to reiterate that the testimony I am giving reflects my personal views and not that on behalf of any client or other individual or organization. I wish to make a few comments before the question and answer portion of today's hearing. First, the Supreme Court's holding in Citizens United has a direct impact on this rulemaking. The Shays 3 Court stated that the FEC coordination rules must close the door and prevent the use of soft money in federal elections. However, the Supreme Court vitiated that rationale when it held that corporations may sponsor express advocacy advertisements. Also, the Supreme Court opined that lawmaker gratitude and access are not compelling governmental interests that justify burdening speech rights. Therefore, the constitutional landscape has changed dramatically, and the Commission must take this into consideration. Second, the Commission cannot simply reclassify independent speech as coordinated communications through the use of vague and subjective regulations designed to chill First Amendment rights. I'd like to pay Mr. Holman a compliment and cite to one of the comments that they filed in 2004 in response to the political committee status rulemaking, where the definition of expenditure was at issue. And while discussing nonprofit organizations that are at issue today in this rulemaking, they stated, quote, discussion of issues of public concern, which may carry with it criticism or praise of elected officials who are candidates for federal office, is central to the mission of such organization and is entitled to substantial constitutional protection. Defining all communications that attack, oppose, promote, or support candidates as expenditures, and I understand we're in the coordination rulemaking, but the content filter is still relevant here, under FECA would sweep within the scope of FECA regulation almost everything done by organizations devoted to the discussion of or advocacy of positions on issues of public importance. The implications of such an expansion of FECA coverage would be huge, end quote. The PASO standard focuses on the information conveyed in each communication as opposed to the action urged. Information conveyed about the policy positions of an officeholder may be deemed to promote or oppose the officeholder referenced in the advertisement, even if the communication contains a clear, non-electoral call to action. Third, the Commission must continue to use the content standard as a filter to determine what types of communications are subject to regulation and possible prohibition. The content of each communication is the only factor that remains within the control of the speaker. Vague and subjective standards remove such control from the speaker and place it in the hands of the commission for after-the-fact manipulation. Inquiries focusing on intent and effect and using contextual factors are prohibited under the relevant case law. Therefore, the proper content standard is the appeal-to-vote standard articulated by the Supreme Court in Wisconsin Right to Life. If a communication does not contain express advocacy or its functional equivalent, it falls outside of the commission's jurisdiction and is not subject to regulation under the coordination rules. Finally, the commission's vague and subjective content standards have forced many speakers and vendors to seek the safety of the firewall safe harbor provision. The fact that so many groups have sought protection under this provision serves as evidence of an uncertain and ill-defined regulatory environment. The commission must preserve the firewall safe harbor as a means to mitigate the effect of politically motivated complaints designed to harass respondents. In sum, the coordination rulemaking implicates core First Amendment values, and the commission must narrowly tailor its regulations to address the specific issues at hand. I am happy to answer any questions you may have, and thank you for the time.
Thank you, Mr. McGinley. We'll now turn to questions from the commissioners. We'll start with Vice Chair Bowerly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to start with Mr. Holman, if I might. Your comment recommends that we adopt the PASO standard in response to the court's concern that the prior rule did not rationally separate election-related advocacy from other speech. And some commenters, including two on either side of you, have expressed some concern about this other area of speech, in particular lobbying activity and advocacy. I'd like you to please comment on this concern and whether, in your view, a PASO standard provides sufficient clarity to avoid reaching this non-election-related speech.
Thank you for the question. First of all, I want to emphasize, especially in response to my colleagues here on my right and left, that we are not talking about defining independent expenditures and independent expenditure activity. We are talking about the same type of activity that candidates are subject to. The PASO standard is something that all the courts, including the Citizens United Court, has recognized can define exactly what a candidate does. The Citizens United Court, the Wisconsin Right to Life Court, we're only talking about independent expenditure activity by outside third-party groups. They never, never went so far as to say something like a PASO standard does not define a campaign ad run by a candidate or a party. In fact, all these courts have assumed that any ads run by candidates and parties are, if they're designed to affect a federal election, are in fact subject to the regulations and are appropriately captured. They can be captured by the PASO standard as well. So the courts have, you know, generally recognize the PASO standard is applicable when it comes to candidate communications. And when we're talking about coordinated communications with candidates, we are talking about candidate communications. This is a standard that is applicable here because you can assume that any communication run by a candidate, as long as it's designed to influence the federal election, is in fact designed to influence the federal election and can be captured under the regulatory regime. The McConnell Court, for instance, recognized that the PASO standard was certainly adequate. Using their quotes, it gives a person of ordinary intelligence a reasonable opportunity to know what is a campaign ad versus what is not a campaign ad. The Federal Election Commission as well uses the PASO standard when it comes to defining federal election activity. So it is a standard that is sufficiently broad to capture candidates' intended coordinations, but at the same time, it is a standard that one knows what it means. I mean, I believe it was my colleague on the right. No. Left, sorry, one of them, argue that suppose a communication said just a statement of fact that Representative X voted three times against abortion rights. That is just a statement of facts, and that would not be subject to the PESO standard unless the communication, of course, goes on to say, therefore, you should thank Representative X for his vote, or in some other way implied support or opposition to the policy statement of the abortion rights issue. It is a sufficiently clear standard that reasonable persons know what it means.
Okay, thank you. Mr. McGinley, I think you would, as I read your comments, you don't agree that that standard is sufficiently clear, and one of the issues in particular that you've raised is about notice to those who would have to gauge their activities under it. And I would like some further clarification. You've expressed your concern that there's no notice because there's no definition. Of course, we provided alternative definitions for a potential PASO standard. And my question is your concern that these proposed definitions don't provide sufficient notice, or that there could be no definition in your view that could be workable enough to provide people with notice as to what activity would be captured?
I'd make a couple of points in response to that question. The first is that the PASO standard was enacted in McCain-Feingold to limit the scope of the FEC's jurisdiction with respect to political party committees. So that communications put out by a political party committee that did not PASO a federal candidate, or by a state candidate that did not PASO a federal candidate, would not be subject to federal regulation. So the congressional intent behind the PASO standard is to apply to political committees either already registered with the commission or for state candidates who are basically referencing a federal office holder. They were never intended to apply to organizations that are outside the commission's regulation, such as a nonprofit group or, for now, a for-profit corporation engaging in advocacy. The second thing I'd like to say is that one of the things that Mr. Barron raised, and I agree with, which is that, you know, the lobbying and the grassroots lobbying component of this type of rulemaking that has the potential to be over-inclusive under the PASO standard, is that when organizations, for reasons not related to an election, engage in advocacy on issues and ask constituents to contact their lawmakers, or for that matter, potentially even candidates, to express an opinion on an issue, is not election-related speech. Now, under the expansive definition of PASO, that would be subject to the coordination rules, and I think would have a chilling effect on the open discussion of important issues of the day. We see that Congress is continually bringing up issues late into the campaign season. They should not have a free speech zone. They should not have the ability to chill the discussion because organizations are engaged in both direct lobbying and grassroots lobbying and using those contacts as an ability to stifle the free expression of political ideas.
Thank you. I think one of the things we're trying to figure out is where the line is between independent speech and coordinate. That is the point of these, of the reg itself. And so I think while it's the frames in which you're using about starting from a point of independent speech or starting from a point of candidate communication because it's coordinated, that doesn't get us to the line drawing. And I think that's what we're trying to do. I'd like to move to the functional equivalent test and talk about that in terms of whether it can meet the court's standard for the Shays Court standard for rationally separating election-related activity. And I know the Citizens United Court, obviously, following the Wisconsin Right to Life test, found that the Hillary the movie was, in essence, a feature-length negative advertisement that urged viewers to vote against Senator Clinton for president, and went on to, as it was applying the test, would be understood by most viewers as an extended criticism of Senator Clinton's character and her fitness for the office of president. So I guess I'd like to hear from each of you briefly, because I think my time is almost up. In your view, in light of the Supreme Court's application of the functional equivalent test, can that test be viewed as covering election-related activity outside of the windows in a way that is sufficient to meet the Shays Court's concern? As we've all stated, that is our primary goal here. We obviously have to be informed by other decisions, but we are under a court order here. So if you could please respond.
If I could go first, Commissioner, I think the Hillary the movie as an example is a little complicated because the lower court had concluded it was expressed advocacy, and the Supreme Court, in its opinion, didn't really rule one way or the other because it said it's clearly with an electionary communications, and it certainly is pejorative. And for purposes of our First Amendment constitutional decision, whatever it is, we conclude that it cannot be prohibited when it's independently financed by the Speaker. I think that the Wisconsin Right to Life standards will satisfy the Shays Court in the following way. First of all, the Shays Court said that the express advocacy standard was too limited, and you ought to reach out and, in a rational basis, include some additional election-related speech that, if coordinated, would constitute a contribution. So what does the Wisconsin Right to Life standard provide to you? It says that certain speech, even though it references a candidate, is not a limited electioneering communication within the 30 and 60-day period because it pertains to issue advertising and is not sufficiently election-related. So our comments and those of other comments suggest, well, take that principle. And we know that in the 30, 60-day period, an electioneering communication cannot be coordinated whether it's exempt under Wisconsin Right to Life or not. And extend that beyond the 30, 60-day period to encompass only the election-related speech and not the issue speech. And that is important because you there is no prohibition on coordinated issue speech outside of the 30, 60-day period. If independent groups and legislators want to discuss an advertising campaign to pass a bill, as I think we will see in the near future if health care reform is going to come up for a vote again, that type of coordination is not election-related and cannot be subject to this regulation because, in our opinion, it interferes with the First Amendment right of petitioning government. And also the sponsors of McCain-Feingold repeatedly said, we do not intend to interfere with bona fide legislative activity, whether it's the content or whether it's the collaborative nature of legislative activity. I mean, legislators have to coordinate. They have to coordinate with their constituents. They have to coordinate with their various private groups that support their legislative agenda. I mean, that's part of being a legislature. And that's what you are trying to separate, and I think the Wisconsin Right to Life gives you some standard. Although the functional equivalent definition in part contemplates that the regulation in that context is limited to the 30, 60 days. That's part of being functionally equivalent. It's within the 30, 60 days. But you are trying to fashion a standard for another purpose, dealing with coordination, and the court has says we just want some rational basis. And it seems to me that the Supreme Court has offered you one rational basis, which is, well, okay, if it's election-related in the 30, 60-day period, then maybe we extend that for purposes of coordination, even though it's not subject to reporting, for example.
The Wisconsin Right to Life functionally related standard, I do not believe, would survive another Shays court scrutiny. It is a smidgen beyond the magic words test, but so narrow that it does not capture most or nearly all campaign communications. Now, once again, I want to reiterate, we're talking about candidate communications here when we're talking about coordinated communications. Could you imagine if the Federal Election Commission were suddenly to design the regulatory regime of campaign ads, contribution limits, disclosure requirements, and so forth, applying it to candidates using just the functional equivalent standard? Literally all candidate communications would escape regulation under that standard. That is why the courts have rejected this type of standard for coordinated communications beyond the pre-election window. It would not capture nearly all the campaign ads that would be sponsored by or promoted by candidates and their campaigns. I want to reiterate one other point, too. When we're talking about the PESO standard as a content criteria, No one is suggesting that that is a standalone standard, that any communication beyond the pre-election window that Peso's a candidate would be captured. That is not the what's being discussed here. What's being discussed here is that is one prong of a two-prong test. So if it actually is Pesoing a candidate, then you take a look at the conduct standard, and do those come into play as well? Have they been encouraged by candidates? Are they, you know, are candidates materially involved? Have there been substantial discussions with candidates? That is the test of coordinated communications as to whether they qualify as actual candidate campaign ads and not independent expenditure ads.
I would go back to what I said in the opening statement, which is that the reason that the Wisconsin Right to Life standard works, the reason that it separates the election-related speech from other speech, such as issue advocacy or grassroots lobbying, is because it focuses on the appeal in the communication itself. It does not focus on the information conveyed, the facts that are conveyed by the speaker. Instead, it asks, what is the reasonable interpretation of that communication? Is it an appeal to vote for or against a candidate, or is there some other plausible meaning that communication conveys that would put it outside the scope of the commission's regulation? I think what's critically important here is to remember what Citizens United, when it talked about coordination, it cited to Buckley on page 47. And Buckley on page 47 discusses expenditures that are made with coordination or prearrangement. Expenditures being the defined term that the court focused on. And in fact, they refer to footnote 53, where the Senate report uses the example where a candidate asks a supporter to place a billboard endorsing that candidate, in other words, containing express advocacy. And so it's important to go back and look at Citizens United. It's important to go back and look at what the court was saying in Buckley about where the lines are on this. It's critically important that the commission continue to use the content standard as a filter to decide which communications and activities are subject to regulation and possible prohibition, and not try and bootstrap on the conduct standard so that speakers will be afraid to speak because they are worried about the intrusive investigations that are typically conducted in connection with coordination inquiries. And so we need to give the speakers the ability to control whether or not they want to be subject to regulation by the commission, so that their political opponents, and frankly for the commission, not to be able to second guess and import a meaning into those words that are not supported by the plain words of the communication itself. The content of the communication is the only thing that remains within the control of the speaker. And I think that's something that's very important for the commission to keep in mind when deciding whether or not to go with the PASO standard or the Wisconsin Right to Life standard, is whether or not the speakers have fair notice so that they can make informed decisions about whether or not they want to engage in regulated activity.
Thank you. Commissioner Hunter.
Thank you. A little bit more specific on the WRTL standard, as I mentioned in my opening comments. I would like to know from the panel if you think that the WRTL standard as proposed in the NPRM would benefit by an additional sort of objective kind of test lobbed on to WRTL. And for example, do we pick out parts of 114.15 or along the lines of something that Lynn Utrich suggested in her comments on page 3 of her supplemental? She suggests that the conduct standard should apply to those communications that contain express advocacy or are unambiguously related to an election because they make reference to a candidacy, voting, or an election. And so again, the question is the standard as it was in the NPRM sufficiently clear, or would it benefit by something along the lines of an objective portion requiring that the communication refer to candidacy, voting, or an election?
Yeah, you want to answer that, Jan? We're waiting for you.
I'll wait for Bill.
Oh, okay. I'll go first. Once again, I think that Ms. Utrich's standard gets closer to where we should be with Wisconsin Right to Life. In other words, the items that she lists as far as being contained within the communication, the candidacy, the act of voting, or the election, do, you know, reference, you know, the election context. They reference, you know, but once again, I need to go back to and emphasize it needs to focus on the action urged in the communication. And the reason is, and I think the Supreme Court, the majority opinion in Citizens United did a very good job of this. Number one, they said that in the time period immediately preceding an election is when most political speech is going to occur. It's when the general public starts paying attention. And there may be opportunities for groups that have an issue agenda to want to comment on those issues in the context of an election. Not urge any election action, but basically to highlight their issue. Why? Because Congress may be coming back into session after the election for a lame duck session. It may be that they believe they can help shape the legislative priorities in the next Congress. And so what we need to do is make sure that we are focusing on the action urge. The other thing that the Supreme Court, I thought, did a very good job of was stating what happens in reality. And that is that most political communications are generated not because of some grand plan that's laid out a year in advance or 6 months in advance. It's the give and take of political discussion. Is that a lot of political communications are sponsored, are put up on the air, reacting to either events in the Congress, events on the ground, or speech by their opponents. And so, you know, when we get to the conduct standard, we can talk about that in connection with the common vendor. But I thought that was a very insightful point that the court brought to the forefront. And that is that political speech is a game of give and take. It's not some grand scheme that's laid out. And so when people want to react, I mean, people forget that Ross Perot in his campaign, I think it was 92, was the one who really drove the deficit as a major issue. Many groups who were into, you know, cost controls or good government may have wanted to comment on that in the context of the election. Why? Because the American people were paying attention. And so they needed to have the freedom to engage in that issue discussion without fear of regulation or prohibition. And so that's why I think that, you know, Ms. Utrecht's standard gets closer to where we should be, but I thought the court was very forceful in the point that that an objective standard in Wisconsin Right to Life had been turned into this complicated two-part 11-factor test. And that it really removed the discretion from the speaker, who gets to control the content of their advertisements and decide whether or not they want to subject themselves to regulation, and put it into an after-the-fact analysis that would get into intent, effect, and use contextual factors to possibly, you know, subject them to regulation that they didn't want to be subjected to.
That sounds a bit like an argument to weaken the content criteria and the coordination regulation within the pre-election window, which, you know, my impression is not a whole lot of commenters were really asking for. Currently, within the pre-election window, within the 90-day and 120-day pre-election window, the content standard criteria seems fine. I mean, essentially, electioneering communications, express advocacy, as well as PESO. I mean, literally all of it, and it covers it fairly well and rather substantially. And that is not what is under contention under the Shays 3 order, and I did not really think was under consideration as part of this rulemaking process. What we're really focusing on, once again, is outside the pre-election window. And I want to emphasize and repeat again the standard that's being discussed here with Wisconsin Right to Life functional equivalency standard is something that the courts have applied to independent communications, independent expenditures. This is not something that any of the courts have applied to candidate communications, and that necessarily means it really has no place being discussed in terms of coordinated communications, which are to be treated the same as candidate communications.
I think the question is whether the Wisconsin Right to Life standard should be modified by the language in the proposed rule. Is that correct?
Yes, and if I might, I think the chairman just told me that we are considering, I think we've agreed to leave the comment period open for some time afterwards. So if people want to think about it a little bit more and submit comments in response to my question or whatever other question, mm-hmm. I think we agreed that that was something we were willing to do.
Well, I appreciate that, and we might take the commission up on that opportunity because in our comments we do suggest that the additional language actually increases ambiguity and lack of clarity rather than clear things up, and because the existing Wisconsin Right to Life standards are clear. They pattern the Supreme Court's decision, and of course they have been used already in one election and seem to be understandable to the regulated community. I would just like to comment that the courts have really not dealt with the coordination issue in enforcement type cases. In fact, I think the only time the Supreme Court has actually commented on it was in the Colorado case, the 1996 Colorado decision, which upheld the constitutional right of political parties to engage in independent expenditures. And in that case, the commission did assert, both in the Tenth Circuit and in the Supreme Court, that the Colorado Party had coordinated its advertising with the candidates because they help candidates, and there were some general assertions that parties really like to assist their candidates. So that's why they're in the business that they're in. And the court simply rejected that type of a generalized assertion. So, well, whatever coordination is, that it's not that. There's got to be some specific planning and collaboration with the candidates. And since that time, I don't think the court has commented on coordination at all. The Shays Court has commented on it in the context of this rule. And I read the Shays Court's opinion to say, well, it's got to be more than express advocacy, and it's got to be rational. So you commissioners come up with something that's a little more than that and rational. And I think our comments are saying, well, Wisconsin Right to Life, it's a pattern after a Supreme Court decision, you know, is more, and it seems to be somewhat rational here. Now, I don't know if the Court of Appeals is going to disagree again, but it seems to me that they've given you an invitation to come up with something, as opposed to PASO, which nobody since the Supreme Court vaguely commented on it has been able to interpret, and certainly would not be understandable by the regulated community.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to follow up on a couple of the points that were pursued by my colleague. All right, let me start with PASO. I understand, and I'm going to direct this to Mr. Barron and Mr. McGinley. It seems to me that the argument that you've made so far about PASO, well, let me back up a sec. We've gotten a lot of comments that say we shouldn't use PASO because it's vague and overbroad. And it seems to me that what you've said so far has mostly addressed the overbreath aspect, that you think it particularly you, Mr. McGinley, that it encompasses what you believe ought to be, you know, legitimate protected lobbying communications. But I want to focus a little bit on the vagueness, which is something that Mr. Barron kind of touched on a second ago. Promote, support, attack, and oppose. These aren't arcane Latin terms. They are two-syllable words that people without law degrees use every day of the week. Dare I say, people of ordinary intelligence use these words and understand them. And I suspect that if I were to approach either one of you at a cocktail party and say, wow, I saw an ad last night that really attacked Candidate Jones, neither one of you would squint your eyes and scratch your head and say, I'm sorry, what was that word, attack? I don't understand that word. What does it mean? You know what it means. And yet the argument is frequently made that nobody knows what promote, support, attack, or oppose means, and nobody can figure out how to apply these terms. So I'm asking you, I mean, this strikes me as a lawyer's argument, that, you know, if you walk out inside this building and ask 10 people, do you understand what the word attack means? You're not going to find any of those 10 people who's going to say, no, I don't know what that means. So help me out here. When you say you don't know what it means, what do you really mean? Either one of you.
Well, a couple of things. I mean, first of all, Craig Holman has indicated that if somebody wrote an ad that says so-and-so is voted against abortion funding by the federal government three times, that's okay. It doesn't promote or attack or support. But if they then went on and say and call up the congressman or congresswoman and tell them to keep voting or not to vote that way, I guess it would. Is that right? I find that vague. I'm not sure what the difference is. But let's take another example. Let's assume that this mythical congressman is in a close race in New York City, and the ad says, Congressman so-and-so has voted against abortion funding three times. Call up the congressman and tell him to continue voting that way. But the abortion issue in that particular district is not in favor of that particular position. Is that ad promoting the candidate or attacking the candidate? It's a little bit, like the story of Congressman Joe Wagner of Louisiana, who was known as a very virulent segregationist. He decided he was going to support Senator Kennedy for president in 1960. He went up to him, according to the story, and said, well, Jack, I'm all for you, so tell me what you want me to do. You want me to come out for you or against you?
I would simply say that the term attack what? Did you attack the policy position taken by the federal office holder who happens to be a candidate? Or are you attacking the candidate themselves? And so that's where it begins to break down in practical application. Because an advertisement that says, call Congressman McGinley and tell him to vote no on bailouts after I go through a litany of the votes that I've taken on bailout legislation, is that promoting me? Is that attacking me? Or is that attacking the issue? It seems to me that that type of advertisement fits exactly within the definition of grassroots lobbying under another body of law, which would be the Internal Revenue Code and the IRS regulations. Is it a communication to the general public? Is it discussing a legislative issue? Is it asking the viewers or the listeners or the readers to contact the official with the authority to influence that issue and ask them to take some sort of action? Or is the general public going to express some sort of view about the issue to the office holder? I mean, how many close votes have there been in Congress lately? How many times can you identify swing districts where a legislative issue, the outcome of the legislative vote, can be determined by running advertisements in eight congressional districts? Those aren't election related. That has everything to do with the legislative issue at hand. And so some could say, well, you're just running that advertisement because you want to attack the office holder who happens to be a candidate. You're basically teeing up the issue for the election. But how is the speaker supposed to have advance notice? When can I run an ad that attacks an office holder for a position and then ask the viewers to contact that office holder and ask them to vote a different way? Is that election related? The office holder may be out there talking about it on the campaign trail, but that is something beyond the control of the speaker. And so when does the speaker get to maintain control? They get to maintain control when you lay out an objective, bright-line test. And the Wisconsin Right to Life test is one that encompasses more than the magic words in Buckley. It's one that goes beyond the explicit terms to vote for or against. It's a standard that is susceptible of no other reasonable interpretation than an appeal to vote for or against. And so attack and promote are vague, and they break down in practical application when you begin to apply them to specific advertisements, especially where you're discussing incumbent office holders who happen to be candidates discussing, frankly, radioactive issues.
So it sounds like what you're arguing is that the vagueness and the overbreath are kind of interrelated.
Correct.
Mr. Holman, do you want to respond, particularly because they're citing to your analysis and as demonstrating their point?
Sure.
Can I just interject that I meant that as a compliment?
I took it that way, actually. I want to make this point over and over again because I've seen it come up in all the comments that are being offered here. And that is, a lot of commenters are choosing to view the PESO standard or this content criteria as a standalone standard, as if that alone determines that there is coordinated communication going on with the candidate. This is not a standalone standard. By having something like the Wisconsin Right to Life standard or the Express Advocacy standard for communications outside that the pre-election window, as the buying time studies show, and actually your own research shows, it affects very little, very few communications, very few ads. Already, are most ads then are just automatically disqualified from consideration of being coordinated with a campaign, even if the candidate asks for that type of ad to be run outside that pre-election window. So what the Shays 3 court is asking you to do is to come up with a standard that accurately captures the coordination between a candidate and a sufficient content standard that works in tandem with that conduct standard. So we're not talking about PESO as a standalone issue. This isn't regulation of lobbying activity, grassroots lobbying outside the window. This is just one of the criteria that helps define when a candidate is running an election-related ad outside that window through coordinated activities.
Let me switch my focus to the Wisconsin Right to Life standard and its clarity. Mr. Barron, you said in your comments that the commission's regulation interpreting the Wisconsin Right to Life ruling provided a level of clarity that allows third-party speakers to understand in advance whether their communications will be subject to regulation. You seem to feel, at least at that time, and I'll give you the opportunity if you want to back off from that, but you seem to feel, at least when you submitted these comments before Citizens United, that the extra stuff in the regulation that the commission passed actually was helpful. And I assure you that that certainly was our goal. It has become a controversial rulemaking, and I don't want to, you know, get into a debate about that, but that certainly was our goal, to improve clarity and to provide better guidance. So I guess my first question is, in light of what the Citizens United Court said about that rule, do you want to revise and extend your comments on that? Do you have different feelings about it today?
I'm afraid I didn't quite follow that. Are you saying that we didn't say it was clear?
No, I think you said you did say it was clear.
And I think we said it again in these comments, right?
Yes, that's what I'm talking about. In these comments, you said that it was clear.
And we incorporate the rule in our comments at pages 10 and 11.
You
right?
did, but this was before CU, and CU says it was ambiguous, that same rule. So I'm giving you the opportunity to back off if you want to.
Thank you. We've actually have had experience with your rule during the 2008 election and the Massachusetts special election. And the safe harbor works. You know, we understand it. Our clients understand it. We have to review all kinds of lobbying, advertising, and other types of advertising throughout the year. And this is helpful. This was helpful in this 30-60-day period. And my point here is that if you extended this principle beyond a 30-60-day period, I think people would understand it and would help. I understand the Supreme Court may have made other comments on it, and obviously Mr. Holman has made other comments on it. But I see your objective here is to be relatively limited. You're trying to respond to the Court of Appeals.
We are trying to respond to the Court of Appeals.
And maybe someday down the road someone else will have a better idea. But, you know, this is the best that I think the regulated community can come up with right now.
But I guess my question is, because here's my concern. If we were to adopt the Wisconsin Right to Life standard and the Supreme Court seems to frown on our attempts to elaborate on what they apparently view as something that stands on its own as a beacon of clarity. Your comments suggest that you thought that the elaboration in the commission's earlier rule were helpful and made it more clear. And what I don't want to run into is, suppose we were to adopt the Wisconsin Right to Life standard on its own, mm-hmm. you know, sort of in deference to the Supreme Court, who, of course, we want to be deferential to. Mm-hmm. And then we hear from people that actually they don't think it's that clear and they can't figure out where the lines are and it's not a bright line test. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't want to be caught between that rocking that hard place, so I'm asking you guys.
Well, I can't guarantee.
Whether you think it's clear or not.
I can't guarantee the views of other people. I can't guarantee whether future experience will raise other issues that we're not anticipating today. But based on the rule thus far, it seems workable. That's our testimony, both in our comments and obviously in my comments today. So that you can separate what the court has previously said is not election-related, functional equivalent content. You want to separate that other content so that people can go about in their public debate on non-election activity more than 30 to 60 days before an election.
But if, I mean, one possibility is we could just take 114.15 and, move it, basically. Take that whole thing and move it over and say that's now the new coordination standard.
Well, you can't move it. I mean, you got to use it. You still have to use it, or do you not, for reporting and disclaimer
purposes,
right?
For reporting, yeah. Right. Yeah. But we could take something that looked a lot like that and import it into this context, or what we have proposed in the NPRM was to do a stripped-down version of that pretty much has parroted the standard out of the court opinion in Wisconsin Right to Life. Mm-hmm. And, now we have two data points. We've got the Wisconsin Right to Life ads that we now know were not the functional equivalent of Express Advocacy. We've got Hillary the movie and the ads for that we now know are the functional equivalent of Express Advocacy. So if we had just the language from that's in the proposed rule, what is called the modified Wisconsin Right to Life standard, and those two data points of one that is and one that isn't, and I ask this not only to you but also to your colleagues on the panel, would that provide you with the level of clarity that you need?
I think the stripped-down version would not be as helpful as your existing regulation.
Mr. McKinley?
I would simply say, and I don't have the regulation in front of me, but it's, advertisements that discuss what some people would call the qualifications of somebody, or their fitness for office, or possibly commenting on character. Well, how does that apply in the real world? What happens if an advertisement says, you said you were going to vote for lower taxes, you said you were going to shrink the size of government, but then you voted for the bailout, and now the bailout's coming up again. We expect you to keep your word and vote against the bailout. That is an advertisement about legislation, not elections. And so does that comment on the office holder's qualifications? Does it comment on their fitness for office? Does it comment on their character? Some would say yes, but it would not be an election-related ad. It would be an advertisement designed to influence legislative policy, not elections. And so in practical applications, these terms begin to break down as you begin to apply them to real-world advertisements.
But isn't that exactly what the court did in the Citizens United case when they said that Hillary the movie would be understood by most viewers as an extended criticism of Senator Clinton's character and her fitness for the office of the presidency? There's little doubt that the thesis of the film is that she is unfit for the presidency. That seems to be exactly what the court did, what you're telling us not to do.
Right. But at the end of the day, what is happening in the real world with the legislative issues at hand? And so the Hillary the movie was put out during the Democratic presidential primary in 2008. I haven't seen the movie, but it's my understanding that there were some of the interviewees that basically said she can't serve as president, or she cannot be assume the presidency. And they were basically making the functional equivalent of vote for and vote against. This was not a legislative advertisement saying we need to, prevent more bailout legislation, or we need to adopt health care reform, where you talked about the prior positions and voting record of the office holders as a way to convince the viewer that it's in their best interest to contact that office holder to express their views about the legislative issue at hand.
So is it the tagline that distinguishes it?
And which brings me back to my opening comments, which is that the test that you adopt should not focus on the information conveyed. Rather, it should focus on the action urged in the advertisement. If the purpose of the advertisement and the communication says she can't serve as president without saying vote for or vote against, that would be the functional equivalent under Wisconsin Right to Life. However, if it says call, Senator Clinton and tell her to not vote for bailout legislation, that is a clear non-electoral call to action that would place it outside the scope of Wisconsin Right to Life.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize. I'm sure I've taken more than my time, but I found that to be very illuminating.
Thank you for that. Commissioner McGann.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to spend my time with Craig Holman, if I could. I think everyone agrees that when speech is coordinated, it's a different standard than when it's independent. That's your theme. Remember, we're talking about coordinated speech, not independent speech. All these cases are about independent speech, not coordinated speech. But to me, that begs the question. As the vice chair indicated, we're here to determine the line between the two. So to simply say when it's coordinated, it's a different standard really doesn't advance the ball. And your written comments I found interesting because, for example, heading B, FEC has struggled to develop effective coordination rules for independent expenditures. Well, I would hope so, because if they're independent, the coordination rules wouldn't govern, right?
That's right.
So how have we struggled to develop effective coordination rules for independent expenditures? Every case I read says we can't do that.
That's right. I would have been mixing terminology there.
Okay. And that's something that is a theme that I think we all need to keep in mind. Terminology here matters, right? What is an expenditure? What's not an expenditure? What's express advocacy? What's not express advocacy? Your comments, you talk about overt express advocacy versus other express advocacy. I've read Buckley many times. They seem to define express advocacy. What's the difference between overt express advocacy and regular express advocacy? I don't follow when you sort of italicize things in your comments for something's really express versus isn't it express or it's not?
By that phrase, I meant by overt express advocacy, the magic words test, vote for, vote against. By other express advocacy, I meant the functional equivalent of express advocacy.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. I'd like to explore a little bit where I've actually heard some agreement between you and Mr. McGinley. Stating facts, so-and-so voted against something, that doesn't have an electoral relation, as I understand what you said earlier. And remember, Shays 3, we have to determine what's the difference between campaign-related speech and not campaign-related speech. So even if it's – do we agree that if something is coordinated in the lay sense of the word, meaning there's been discussion between a politician and an outsider over something that is not election-related, do we agree that that's beyond the reach of what we're doing here at the commission?
I would agree that a pure statement of fact without any other context of, of supporting the certain, stances of the candidate wouldn't qualify under the PESO standard. Now, just a pure statement of fact could qualify under the electioneering communications standard, for instance, just by reference to a candidate. But that is not the standard I am advocating for outside the pre-election window. I think we should have a weaker standard than merely an electioneering communication standard outside the 120-day window, and PESO seems to be the best and appropriate standard.
Now, when you say electioneering communication standard, you mean the statutory, you mean reference? The terminology, again, I'm getting lost. What do you mean by electioneering communication standard?
Yes, just merely referring to a candidate within that time frame.
Okay. A statement of fact, though, if it is done in consultation, even at the suggestion of a candidate, is that a problem we have to worry about? Because we just said it doesn't PESO. So let's say it's beyond PESO. Is that's permissible?
It would be coordinated communications within the 120-day window. If you were to apply the PESO standard outside the 120-day window, it would not qualify as coordinated communication.
Okay. Now, your earlier, in response to an earlier question, and it's come up a couple times, if you state so-and-so voted against funding for abortion three times, but you add the tagline, call him and thank him for those votes, that somehow becomes promote, attack, support, oppose.
Yes, that is then expressing support for that position.
Okay. Let's say the call to action says call the congressman and tell him what you think about those votes.
That's
now we're in the studio. We have 30. We have time running here. We're making an edit to an ad. We have to get it out the door, and we have to change traffic, and we have to get to the station.
Right.
Okay. So we don't give time to wait. The question is, can we do that ad or not?
Without any other context of the ad, and it just does a statement of fact, and then says, "Call the congressman and express what you think." Without any other context of this ad, that itself does not pay so.
Well, let me ask you this.
I couldn't imagine an ad running like that.
Let's assume that's the only text. How could it pay so?
Happy picture, happy music, maybe? That would not pay so. As long as there wasn't an expression of support or opposition or promoting or attacking that the position of the candidate, that would not qualify under the peso standard.
Let me ask you this. You're familiar with the advertising that was at issue in Wisconsin Right to Life?
Yes.
Okay, so everyone else, let me refresh your recollection. It was an ad that concerned judicial nominations, and it was an ad the Right to Life folks wanted to air that mentioned Senators Cole and Feingold, and it was close to Senator Feingold's reelection, and it urged them not to block now Justice Alito's ascension to the U.S. Supreme Court about filibustering judicial nominations. Would that ad be peso under your standard?
That ad would be peso, but first of all, this ad was within the electioneering communications window, so it qualifies as electioneering automatically. But yes, that would also qualify as peso had it been done way outside the electioneering communications window.
So where's the electoral link between an ad that talks about judicial nominations and the election?
The electoral link is by expressing support or opposition to the policy preferences of a candidate for office. That is the electoral link.
How do you square that with the language in Buckley that the discussion of issues and the discussion of candidates devolves in practical application?
I didn't understand the question.
How do you square that with the language in Buckley that says the difference between issue speech and electoral speech devolves, it dissolves in practical application?
Because that is not the sole standard that is being applied here. That is just the content criteria. Remember, this is not a standalone criteria in determining whether or not a certain speech or communication is promoting or opposing a candidate. This is just one prong of the content criteria. It does express support or opposition to where a candidate stands on an issue, and then, which could be an issue advocacy, but then if it is in fact coordinated through the conduct at the suggestion of a candidate, then it meets the other prong and becomes a candidate communication. Even a candidate ad under Buckley that did exactly that ad would be classified as a campaign ad supporting or opposing the candidate and subject to the regulation. The only way it is viewed as issue advocacy outside the regulatory framework for a candidate is if it is an independent expenditure by a third party and not coordinated with the candidate.
See, again, that begs the question over what's coordinated or what's not coordinated, because in the context of judicial nominations and when folks run ads in judicial nominations, that tends to be based upon how senators are going to vote, and a lot of that is done in very open and notorious coordination with Capitol Hill. At least that's my understanding. Never worked in the Senate, but from the outside looking in, that seems to be how that works. So it seems to me that if there's a judicial nomination – that can no longer be coordinated if PASO is the standard year-round, assuming that the Wisconsin Right to Life ad that the Supreme Court said the government couldn't regulate. PASO becomes the standard. That kind of advertising could not be at all coordinated with who you need to coordinate that with in the Senate or perhaps the White House. Is that where this leads?
I'm actually not sure where you're leading on this. I'm trying to keep this pretty straightforward and simple. that if a candidate does at the suggestion or materially contributes to a third-party communication that does pay so that either supports that candidate or attacks the opponent, that that would qualify as a coordinated communication. Is that where you're leading? I'm not sure.
I'm trying to figure out how a judicial nomination ad has anything to do with an election to office. It seems to me that's certainly one of the things senators do that is the duty of a senator that is not tied to the election. Now, maybe his vote at some point weighs in on voters' minds at some point, but we know that's not enough. I mean, let's keep talking around the Wisconsin Right to Life ad, and let's assume the call to action was call these two senators and tell them what you think about Judge Alito. Does that make the ad okay? This is assuming the conduct prong is satisfied. My whole hypothetical, assuming that there's the conduct prong is satisfied. We're simply talking about the content prong.
And it's outside the electioneering communications window. If you take all those considerations into effect, it would not qualify under the PESO standard. The Wisconsin Right to Life ad that you're specifically talking about, by the way, was a duplication of another ad that the same group did 2 years earlier targeting Senator Cole, and the second one, I believe, was targeting Senator Feingold. It wasn't really focusing on the judicial candidacy. It was an electioneering communications within that 60-day window, which was trying to portray Cole originally, and then 2 years later they just changed the faces and put Feingold in there. It was designed to affect voter attitudes towards Cole or Feingold.
How do you know that?
That is my judgment of the ad itself. The fact that it was a duplicate ad 2 years apart, same ad, same criteria, just focusing on two different office holders when they happened to be running for election. I did not produce the ad.
So they ran an ad 2 years before Justice Alito, then now Justice Alito, was nominated. I think the ad had Cole and Feingold in it with Alito.
Yeah, both times it did have both senators in it.
Oh, okay.
But it did emphasize.
Did I miss something? Was there an amendment to the Constitution? Was Cole on the ballot 2 years in a row?
No.
No.
But one of the office holders was running for office. Remember, too, I mean,
so,
this is
an
electioneering communication.
Does that then preclude you from running an ad trying to sway that politician's vote on confirming a judge simply because that person's on the ballot within that cycle?
Well, under BCRA, with the electioneering communications provision, it would have required that the ad not be paid for by corporate or union money.
And we know what the Supreme Court said about that theory.
Right.
Right. Now, let's turn to PESO itself. I think I must have missed something, because my understanding with how the PESO standard was sold was that it wasn't a content standard per se or a limitation. It was designed to avoid circumvention of the limits, meaning a federal office holder, even in the wake of the soft money ban of the national parties, could still in theory raise soft money or attend an event, not really raise soft money, but raise money for a state party. Or the state party could then use soft money the federal office holder didn't raise to benefit that federal office holder's election, and hence the federal election activity concept that if it promotes, attacks, supports, or opposes the federal office holder, the state party, local party, could not use non-federal money. Same thing with state and local candidates. So now it was designed to be an anti-circumvention measure, and now it's going to be used as a content standard for coordination. I don't see those as being the same thing, and I'd ask actually either Mr. Beginley or Mr. Barron, does that seem to be your recollection of what PESO was about, and can we then take that kind of standard and export it into a coordination analysis?
That is my understanding of how the PESO standard came about. The other thing that I would like to point that kind of relates to that is that Buckley's distinction between, you know, expenditures that apply to outside groups and expenditures that apply to candidates and political party committees is that if money is dispersed for a communication, even though it doesn't contain express advocacy by a candidate or a political party committee from their federal account, by definition it's going to be an expenditure because they said why else would they do it? They're promoting a federal election somehow or their own candidacy. But with respect to the outside groups, with respect to the independent spenders, they did say that express advocacy needs to be the standard. That it's the only way that you can delineate between what a group is doing in connection with an election versus what the group is doing in other contexts that may be political but not election related. And so the PASO standard seems to be a way, and it's my understanding of how this was done, was so that when state parties that were able to maintain both federal and state accounts, when the state account money was being spent in connection with an election where federal candidates were on the ballot, the state money spent could not PASO the federal office holders on the ballot. So what it did was it made sure that you didn't completely federalize all elections within a state and state party activity. And so it was a line that was drawn so that you would keep the federal side to the federal account and the non-federal pure state activity could be done entirely out of the state account.
Thank you. Just two more questions, Mr. Chairman.
May I respond to this too?
Well, as long as it doesn't cut into my time.
I mean, this exactly is an anti-circumvention standard. I mean, that's what the coordination regulation is all about. It's about making sure that outside groups and candidates do not circumvent the contribution limits and the disclosure requirements that apply to candidate communications, which makes PASO a perfect standard to apply in terms of the content criteria for anti-circumvention.
Mr. McGinley, do you think the ad in Wisconsin Right to Life promoted, attacked, supported, or opposed a federal candidate?
No.
Mr. Barron, do you agree or disagree with that? And if you can't remember the text of the ad and actually want to see the script because, well, that's what very experienced lawyers do before they render opinions, I certainly understand.
Yeah, I don't recall it doing that, but I would like to review the text of the script itself before commenting conclusively of my opinion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Commissioner Walther.
Thank you. I was I'm a little interested in the tension between Wisconsin Right to Life Standard versus PASO, as if it has to be one or it has to be the other. And you can take a standard like express advocacy and build in a safe harbor to reduce the uncertainty of what that means or how it would be implied. And I'm wondering if we could discuss whether or not I have some concerns as to whether or not the Shays Court would accept the Wisconsin Right to Life standards. If we were to do something like apply a PASO standard, and I don't know why it has to be PASO, but it is one bit that's got statutory recognitions. But and whether or not we define it, had a safe harbor that clarified some of the problems that Mr. McGinley referred to and Mr. Barron about when it might be applied, so that and I'm not sure whether you'd have an additional factor of a call to action or not, but I'm interested, Mr. Holman, in how you might see an approach like that. So you take the PASO standard and you try and tighten it up so that you don't and have a safe harbor so people can have greater certainty as to whether or not they're falling in or without it.
I've found some of the safe harbor or actually additional definitions to PASO, especially when it was focusing on things like candidacy or election, not to be appropriate. There was an alternative A, I believe, that was offered to provide other words that would help define what support and oppose mean. And I find that okay. I mean, it doesn't help or it doesn't hurt. Quite frankly, I think we all know what support or oppose means. And so when an ad is something like a pure just statement of fact but makes no commentary on whether or not that is good, bad, support, oppose, or, you know, thankful or horrendous or something else. I mean, that is when you trend into the, you know, into the actual peso standard. I want to also add that the peso standard itself cannot stand. We're always talking about, in terms of a coordination regulation, with coupling it with the conduct standards as part of the coordination regulation.
But that's part of the problem here, is that there are going to be instances where there will be conduct regarding certain content which should not be regulated, should not be interpreted as a contribution. And I think the prime example is the one that we keep bashing or throwing back and forth, that where we have a disagreement. You say that an advertisement outside of 30, 60, 120-day window produced, let's say, at the request of a senator who is a candidate, urging a group to publicize in a particular district another senator's position on legislation, and urging the public to call that other senator and tell him either, you know, vote for this legislation or vote against that legislation, you say that that's promote, attack, support, or oppose, right? Because of the language saying call up the senator and either thank him or tell him to vote another way. And our position is
if it
that's
affects
part of
that
the legislative
campaign,
process.
If it affects that campaign.
Well, wait, we're talking about content. We're talking about the content of the message. And that's the content.
And the conduct standard is whether
you're
or not
saying
that
if another senator had
that
requested
campaign.
that group to engage in that advertisement outside of the window, that's coordinated expenditure that ought to be treated as a contribution. That's where we disagree. I consider that an interference with the group's, if not the senator's, right to legislate and to petition government. That's part of the legislative process. You're saying it's part of the election process, because the content is supporting or attacking this senator for his or her position on this legislation. So let's put it in the real-world context of health care reform. If I understand you correctly, let's say that last December, when there was going to be a Senate vote on the health care legislation, if one of the political parties or one of the senators in that debate went to an association or a union or whatever, the AARP, and said it would really help if you ran some ads in this district urging the viewers to contact their senator before this vote and tell them to support this legislation, that would be passive.
The conduct standard applies when it affects the candidate's own election, not when it affects other elections.
Well, the senator said it would really help my my election if we
if
could
you
pass.
Attack
Henry
my
Reed
opponents.
Says, you know, it really help opponents. If he passed this bill.
And attack my opponents.
Yeah.
That would follow, that would conform to the coordination and content standard. That would be a Harry Reid sponsored ad.
Because of the message in that market.
Maybe I can just make a couple of comments first.
Go ahead, Mr. McGinley, but I got a couple more questions too.
All right. I mean, it seems to me that a number of the factors that we seem to come into play here when discussing the PASO standard is that we're relying on context. We're relying on factors that are beyond the control of the speaker. Is the office holder up for election? What is the timing of the vote? When do we need to air this communication so that it's the most effective for the legislative purpose? Right before the committee votes? Right before the full Senate votes? Is it a discussion about a judicial nomination? And if you ask the reviewers or the listeners to contact them, somehow going beyond providing information about that issue and actually asking the viewers or the listeners to take some sort of legislative action now suddenly magically converts it into a PASO ad because the office holder referenced in the advertisement happens to be a candidate. Now, it can't be that speakers who are engaged in legislative battles, communicating their views to the general public, asking the general public to take some sort of action, where the viewer or the listener can exercise their own free will, whether to comply with that request and contact the lawmaker, is somehow going to magically convert this into an election ad because it either promotes or is perceived to promote or attack because of all these contextual factors and people's gleaning the intent of the speaker and somehow the effect of the communication, even though it discusses the issue and asks people to take a clear non-electoral call to action, somehow the effect of the speech is going to have a residual impact on the election of the officeholder referenced. That can't be the standard. That removes control from the speaker. Speakers are now at the mercy of the regulator who can second guess what they tried to do at the time. That can't be the content standard. And it also goes back to the opening comment where we need to use the content standard as the filter. You can't engage in the coordination analysis. You can't engage in a coordination investigation unless the communication at issue satisfies one of the content standards under the second prong. We can't bootstrap on the conduct standard. Just because somebody airs an advertisement that refers to a federal office holder, They should not suddenly be subject to the intrusive, time-consuming, resource-depleting, money-depleting costs of an investigation to determine what were the contacts, what were the discussions, who talked to who. That depletes the resources of an organization to the point where they must speak less.
Let me go on with this a little bit. I recognize your question, but we're asked to, for example, define. The question is whether to define PASO or not. I'm not sure the definitions that we have forward give us any more clarity because we just use commonly understood words to define a commonly understood word, and I'm not sure if that gets us anywhere when people really want to disagree with something that's going on. So we find ourselves trying to give somebody a hand with a safe harbor, and that's really where I'm heading because you can look at. Major purpose or express advocacy, and we're asked to define major purpose, but it hasn't happened. But on the other hand, we maybe could have safe harbors, for example, on what is and what isn't, and that helps get everybody down the road. I'm suggesting that perhaps if we had something in between PASO because of a safe harbor and Wisconsin Right to Life, that maybe we could find ourselves a little more on a common ground on what PASO is not, as much as trying to find out what it is through definitions. So I'm just wondering, Mr. Barron, would that kind of an approach be more attractive to you than trying to guess what those common words were without definitions that we proposed?
Well, if you created a safe harbor, I would turn again to the 114.15, if you're looking for some guidance in safe harbor, you know, whatever PASO means, it doesn't mean language that urges the viewer to contact a senator or a congressman. It wouldn't mean any content that is focused on legislative, executive, or judicial matters or issues. You know, I mean, that type of content should not be PASO. Even if it urges the viewer to call up Senator so-and-so or Congressman X and tell them to vote for or against a particular piece of legislation or a policy. And that's where I think the difference is. Craig is interpreting policy preferences as promoting and supporting or attacking individuals who happen to be candidates, but they're also legislators and government officials.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think you've got 13 minutes of a read-a-read, so I apologize for.
No problem. I think this has been a very lively and a very fascinating discussion up to this point. We've been focusing primarily on the content standard. I wanted to just briefly touch on the common vendor, former employee conduct standard. And Mr. McGinley, you brought up something that kind of piqued my interest as you were making a point on another matter about the give and take of political campaigns, how what may be the battle plan at one point in time is going to change and maybe change drastically as events overtake that plan. The court in Chase 3, when discussing this the standard talked about that there may be some information that they basically said the commission has not justified why a 120-day standard should be the why is that the right line to draw. So we're in a position where we can either draw a new line or we can justify where the line is right now. In your comments, you'd mentioned that that we should keep the current line, but that we need to better explain that. So I just want to touch on that a little bit more. The court specifically mentioned some things that may whose value may last beyond 120 days, and they specifically mentioned a detailed state-by-state master plan that a chief strategist puts together, donor lists, and lists of supportive voters as information whose value may extend beyond 120 days. Now, you've represented campaigns. You've actually been a general counsel for a party committee, so your experience on these matters, I think, is long and extensive. I guess let me touch on the donor list and the list of supportive voters, those two items of information first. First of all, are those the sorts of pieces of information that a campaign or a party gives out freely?
Of course not. No, because they are assets of the party committee or the campaign. And the other attribute that I'd like to point out, when you're talking about donor lists or voter lists, those are things of value. When you're talking about a common vendor or a former employee, what you're trying to prevent is the use or conveyance of the private plans, strategies, needs, or activities of the campaign or the party committee where the outside group may be coordinating with them. Donor lists and voter lists are not the type of information that the common vendor or former employee conduct standard, the 120 days, is designed to prevent. Those are assets. Okay, so what we're talking about is the people and the information that they may have. A vendor is not, or a former employee is not, going to walk out the door of a campaign with the master plan. It's not going to happen. It's proprietary information of the campaign. It's proprietary information of the party committee. The party committees and the campaigns guard that information jealously. And the reason that they do is because they don't want anybody else to know what they're up to. Because the minute it gets outside, it's going to be leaked to the press and it's no longer a master plan. Now, as you stated before, I believe that the give and take of the campaign cycle is critically important to this as well. Because whatever master plan they may have cooked up, it just gets blown up immediately as soon as the campaign is engaged. You can look at numerous races across the country where everybody thought that the conduct of the campaign was going to go one way. The person should bank the money and wait for the general because regardless of who was on the ballot in the primary, they were just going to sail through. Now you see people engaged in a give and take. There is charges and countercharges. There are attacks and counterattacks. And so whatever game plan had been drawn up is out the window. And it's happening on the Democratic side, it's happening on the Republican side, and that's the nature of politics. And so whatever information people may have thought was valuable in the off year, by the time the summer rolls around in the election year, it's worthless.
With regard to, again, going back to the donor list and list of supportive voters, if a common vendor or a former employee had those pieces of information and then was trying to use those for running an ad, basically we've got larger problems than coordination. I mean, that's the theft of an asset, which is going to subject them to other laws. So there are already pieces, other laws that would govern that. And also with respect, and let's assume that they're just taking what they encapsulate in their head. A donor list and a list of supporter voters, that's going to be thousands, tens of thousands of lists, people long, and maybe a few dozen they can retain in their mind. But if someone is just trying to take with them whatever they retained in their brain, it's generally going to be a fairly small number.
I agree with that.
So let's go to the state-by-state master plan. Like you said, I'm looking back, and I'm assuming, again, drawing on your experience as both a general counsel for a party committee and also in your representational capacity for campaigns, I would imagine that that 4 months ago, the strategy and the master plan for the Republican Party, for example, would be very different than it is now. In fact, would you say, from your opinion, do you think that the master plan 2 weeks before the Massachusetts special election in January was very different than the master plan 2 weeks after that special election?
Yes, I would think they were radically changed based upon the change in the environment. I would say that the master plan that may have been in place 8 weeks out from the Massachusetts special election, where everybody thought that Coakley was going to cruise to election, it was radically different than what happened 2 weeks out when the Democratic Party woke up and realized they had a problem. They were reacting to the environment on the ground in the election. And so all of this talk about how, you know, vendors may be able to, or former employees may be able to carry with them some sort of master plan that's going to carry through 120 days in a political campaign. I mean, I don't think there's been 120 days in this election cycle that has ever been consistent. I think that the environment has changed so radically from right after the inauguration to 6 months later to 6 months after that, that 120 days is frankly a bit over-inclusive. I realize you have to have, you know, some sort of standard, and 120 days has actually worked pretty well because people have become accustomed to it, people are aware of it, and they don't want to violate it. And so people are taking precautions to make sure that they ensure compliance. And that's probably another point that I'd like to make in the context of the conduct standard. I'd say overwhelming number of people try to comply. They read your rules. They seek guidance. They try to understand what they can and can't do. They try to stay on the right side of the line. This is not an environment where people are running around trying to circumvent the rules, evade the rules, or break the rules and disregard them. This is an environment where people are at great expense are trying to, you know, hire lawyers, hire accountants, try to comply with these rules. And one of them is the use of firewalls. Vendors, party committees, and even outside groups, even though they're not specifically referenced in the firewall safe harbor, create internal firewalls. They disrupt the internal operations of the organizations. They force separation between employees of a vendor. They force separation within the internal operations of a political party committee. They are very disruptive, and they are very costly, because in some instances, these groups are engaging in redundant conduct because they're fearful that they can't use or convey any private information, and they want to stay on the right side of the law on this. And so, you know, they're worried about being captured in these coordination rules or being subject to an intrusive investigation. So it's, in their mind, the cost-benefit analysis is, let's pay people on the front side to get the firewalls established to ensure compliance throughout the cycle. And so it's an important part that this remain. The firewall, the sanctity of the firewall safe harbor is something that the commission should preserve and possibly strengthen going forward.
Mr. Barron, you also are second to none in terms of your experience in terms of representing campaigns and also being the former general counsel of a presidential campaign. Do you have anything to add about these master plans? I'm sure that you've not only seen them, but have probably been intimately involved in developing them. And in terms of the value of that information over time as the give and take of a political campaign, as that process evolves, what has been your experience and what sort of value do those have over time from your experience?
Well, I agree with the comments from Bill McGinley. You know, master plans are wonderful. They do tend to go out of date. But let's assume that they still retain some vestigial value. The only additional observation I have about master plans is that usually the entire press and political world knows what the master plan is. And it's pretty much public information. I mean, it's not like some nuclear secret. If a candidate has a strategy, it's not rocket science, and it's usually leaked by some campaign manager to try and prove how brilliant he or she is. You know, so everyone knows what the master plan is, and when things go awry, people start commenting about, well, it's not going according to plan, is it?
So in other words, it isn't a state secret that's guarded under lock and key to any great extent.
Not in my experience, and not for a long time. Maybe back in the 70s, you know, when Pat Caddell and Hamilton Jordan had a master plan for Jimmy Carter. But, I mean, since those days, you know, they're the ones who kind of discovered the Iowa caucuses. Nobody cared about them until 1976. But every campaign for president since then, you know, has had a master plan, which was pretty well known. And my observation of Senate and House so-called master plans are that they're pretty well known, and they all seem to be the same.
So, and I'll ask this of you and of Mr. McGinley. So, from your experience, the sort of information, let's say that, again, they don't take this master plan. Let's assume that that's not something that a former employer or a common vendor was entitled to take away. But they were able to internalize to a certain extent what was in that master plan. And from your experience, is that information, for one thing, that valuable? And is it something that's really not known or fairly much common knowledge anyway as a result of the sorts of leaks that you mentioned.
I think the type of information that would be valuable if it were timely would be, for example, how much money and resources does a campaign have? Well, you know, a lot of that information is public, too, because campaigns file reports. But let's assume that you don't know how fundraising is going in the last or third quarter of a campaign. So if you knew that information and you combined that with, well, that will affect the ability of a candidate to advertise in a particular location, then that would be useful information. But I would point out that that's information that is relevant only on a timely basis, and it usually would have to be well within 120 days of an election.
So it's not the sort of information.
So I think you've already eliminated somebody moving from a campaign that close to election with relevant information to an independent spender that could then say, well, I now have material information about where the candidate needs some additional advertising, and we'll go and make an independent expenditure there.
Is there anything further you wanted to add, Mr. McGinley?
No, I mean, I would agree with that. I mean, you know, as Mr. Barron said, you know, a lot of the campaign plans are going to be leaked, and in fact, the master plans are drawn up to be presented to the press to show the roadmap to victory. And so a lot of this information is already public. It's available from a publicly available source. To any of the details that may remain confidential within a campaign or a party committee, Mr. Barron is correct. I mean, they are going to be disclosed in the FEC report because it's all going to become a question of resources and the like. I would also point out that, you know, most of the information that is going to be of value to others who may be interested in the race without going for the, you know, hiring a former employee or a common vendor is going to be the public file at the television stations, right? I mean, everything that you need to know about a strategy is publicly available. You're going to start to see the buy show up. People are going to ask who placed the buy. The public file at the stations is going to provide that information. You're going to start to see that at the radio stations. You're going to start to hear grumblings from the reporters about what theme the opponent is pushing or what theme others are pushing that are trying to influence what is happening on the ground. And so the information that is especially valuable is available from public sources. And so the whole concept that you're going to be walking out with you know, with some type of document that's going to hold the keys to victory for everybody or for a particular candidate after 120 days is not going to exist because that information goes stale. It is no longer useful.
Thank you. We are getting close to what our assigned time was, but I want to give General Counsel an opportunity to ask questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Given the time constraints, I'll ask this question of the panelists, but if you'd like to reply in the extended comment period, I think that would be fine as well. We've had a lot of discussion about how to formulate or define your preferred content standards, either the WRTL test standing alone or supplemented by the regulation or the PASO standard. I'd like to just ask whether, in addition to that defining and formulating, you would find it useful in the rule and or the explanation and justification to have specific examples and to have a view on whether, whichever content standard the commission chooses, whether that standard is met in those specific examples. And if your answer to that is yes, and perhaps this is best for you to reply to in the extended comment period, could you share with us what examples you'd prefer and your view as to whether they meet the standard, the applicable standard?
Well, since I'm here to promote the Wisconsin Right to Life standard, I think you, in your past rulemaking, have examples, and that would be useful perhaps to repeat.
And since I'm here to promote the PASO standard, I mean, I don't find it particularly useful nor damaging to come up with some examples of what support and oppose means. I do believe PASO is pretty self-understood, but, you know, there's no greater damage or benefits that came out of, for example, alternative A to add further definition to PASO.
Sometimes it is useful. I mean, the only danger with providing the examples is that I don't want the regulated community to be locked in to those examples that are deemed permissible versus those that are not. Because what we don't want to do is take away the creative ability of the speakers to fashion the message that they want to convey. And so what we don't want to do is create a number of examples that lock them into certain type of advertisements for fear if they go outside the box on that, even though they don't meet the legal test, somehow they're going to be subject to investigation or complaints filed. And so with the caveat that the examples would be illustrative only and they're not, you know, a complete list of the type of permissible or prohibited, you know, or regulated communications, I think it does provide some information to the regulated community that's useful.
Staff Director, you have any questions you wanted to add?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No questions at this time.
All right. Any final comments or questions of my colleagues? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to, actually, as a follow-on to our General Counsel's question, ask in supplemental comments, if you choose to submit them, on this question of examples. We have 13 examples in the NPRM. Very few people, in fact, I'm not sure if anybody actually commented on any of them. And in particular, some of them have ambiguous calls to action, no call to action. You know, there's the Bill Yellowtail ad. There's an ad that says the tagline is, "What is he thinking?" I'm not sure what kind of a call to action that is. There's the Real Truth About Obama ad. Is this the change you can believe in? So if you would care to, I would find it very informative if you could, you know, look at some of these ads and give us your opinion. You know, pretend you're us. We get these complaints. We have to look at these ads and decide whether they, you know, come under these standards or not. And under either PASO or Wisconsin Right to Life or both, do you think that these ads would, you know, are ads that we should throw out at the RTB stage or that would meet these criteria and therefore would require some investigation? I would find that, as I said, illuminating. Thank you.
I think why don't we plan on keeping the record open for 10 business days following this hearing for any comments and further submissions that that our witnesses would like to submit. Any other comments or questions by our by my colleagues? I really want to thank the this panel of witnesses. I think that this has been an excellent exchange. I appreciate you for the expertise that you've shared with us and for the thoughts and opinions that you have on this very important rulemaking. I think that this, as has been mentioned by many of my colleagues, this has been a long process, almost a decade-long process, trying to get this one down, and hopefully we can get this right, and certainly your comments will hopefully lead us down the road to successfully concluding this rulemaking. So once again, thank you for your remarks. We will stand in recess until 1:30.